Well, I want to talk to you this morning about the wonderful grace of God, specifically as it flows to us in what the Bible calls the new covenant. Now, you remember it was our Lord Jesus. On the night before his crucifixion, he gathered together in an upper room with his disciples for the sole purpose of celebrating the last Passover with his followers. Now, it was during that final Passover when the Lord stopped and he instituted what we call today as a church the Lord's Supper. You remember how it played out. Jesus lifted up the bread and he said, "This symbolizes my body, which is broken for you. I want you to do this in remembrance of me." And then he lifted up the cup and he says, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim." You might say you give testimony as a group of believers. You remember, you memorialize my death until the day that I return. In other words, I've come to fulfill the old covenant. All of its promises, all that you've anticipated, I have come to fulfill that and to usher in a brand new covenant, which the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 8 is far better than the old covenant. So this morning I want to stress to you just how much greater the new covenant is than the old. The old, which was so dominated by the law of Moses. And the greatness of the new, which is so dominated by the grace of Christ. Now, in saying all that, I don't want you to get the impression at all that the old covenant was void of grace. Because nothing could be further than the truth. The grace of God is seen from the very beginning of the Bible all the way through the Old Testament. Without grace, Adam and Eve could never be forgiven of their sins. Without grace, Enoch never could have walked with God. Without grace, there would still be a flood, but there would be no ark for Noah and his family. Without grace, there would be no promise of God's blessing through Abraham. Apart from grace, the Hebrew people would have died in the crash of the Red Sea along with the Egyptian army. Without grace, they would have died in the wilderness. There would be no manna to sustain them. Without grace, they never enter into the promised land because the walls of Jericho never come tumbling down. Without grace, there is no law to instruct a sinful people as to how to live holy and righteous. Without grace, there's no temple to contain the presence of God. There is no prophet to bring the word of God. What I'm saying, the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, literally is filled with grace. But the New Covenant, in the person of Jesus Christ, brings the grace of God to mankind in the clearest and fullest way possible. I love what John writes. In chapter 1 and verse 14, he says that Jesus is filled with grace and truth. In other words, through the revelation that God gave those under the old covenant, it was all that they needed to know to both know and love God, but it wasn't until Christ came that we got the full revelation of God. It's the same way with the grace of God. Those under the old covenant, they had all the grace they needed to both know and love God. But it's not until the new covenant when Christ came that God manifests his grace in the fullest and clearest way possible. Jesus is filled with grace. He is the fulfillment of all of God's gracious promises that the old covenant anticipated. So yes, there was grace in the Old Testament. We're going to see that this morning. Marvelous grace, immense grace, wonderful grace. Listen, apart from grace, no one, old or new covenant, could ever know God. All of us would be under his judgment, deservedly so. But the new covenant, as we stand before God in Christ Jesus, we are recipients of the fullest and the clearest means of God's grace that any Old Testament saint ever experienced. Now, I think this is exactly what Jesus meant. In Matthew chapter 11 and verse 11, when he was referring to John the Baptist, you remember he said this, among those who are born of women, none of them have as great a privilege as John the Baptist. But those who come after John the Baptist, well, they will be more privileged than he ever was. In other words, the Old Testament saints had great privilege. They had the law. They had Moses. They had the sacrificial system. They had the temple. They had the prophets. But John was more privileged than they were because they all pointed ahead to a coming Christ. John saw Christ. He touched him. He identified him. But more than that, those who have followed John, we have an even greater privilege than John, because not only do we have Moses, not only do we have the prophets, not only do we have the testimony of John the Baptist, but we have Christ himself. The night before he died, Jesus in the upper room with the disciples, John 14:20, I am going to be with my Father soon. And when I go to my Father, I will pray to him that he will send you another, the Spirit of God, just like myself. And on that day when he comes, Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost, you will know that now you are in me and I am in you. Now that's grace. As John wrote in chapter 1 and verse 16 of his gospel, that is grace upon grace, and you could say upon grace, upon grace, upon grace. Now, here's what I want to do this morning. I want to give you a story of God's wonderful grace from the Old Testament. It is a story that is absolutely rich with grace. And the grace of God is manifest here in this story in such a beautiful way. When I came across it years ago, I remember just being shook down to the deepest part of my soul. And it caused me to think to myself, if there was such immense grace available to the saints of the old covenant, then how much more grace do I have available to me in the new covenant? And as I tell you often, certainly, we are the richest people that we know. Well, as we come to our passage, 2 Samuel chapter 23, these are the last kind of official recorded kingly records of David. You see in verse 1, these are the last words of King David, the last, in a sense, maybe official record. And I love what David's doing here. And we do this sometimes. He's looking back over his life and he's recognizing and giving honor to those men who played a vital part in his ascension, in his securing the throne many years ago. So these were men who were absolutely instrumental in bringing David to the crown and then protecting him when he was on the throne and advancing his kingdom to be the greatest that Israel had ever known. What we have here is a list of 37 of David's bravest and most loyal warriors. Now, all of these men were men of incredible valor, as we'll see. They were all Congressional Medal of Honor winners, you might say. They were completely loyal and devoted to David, their king. And each one of them put their lives on the line in such a way that just stands out beyond what was ever expected of a normal soldier. And what David's going to do is this. He's going to give us several stories in the lives of some of these men that illustrate stories that he could give us in the lives of every one of these men. Now, before we actually get into the stories, I want you to take note of verse 5. Verse 5 is absolutely critical to us understanding the story of David's mighty men. David writes, "Truly is not my house so with God." Here's the best way to understand that. David says, although neither I nor my house, my posterity, deserves any of this. None of this was deserved. For he, Yahweh, has made an everlasting covenant with me. Though neither me nor my posterity deserve this, God has chosen by his grace to make a covenant that is everlasting with me and my line. Let me read that to you, and I love to read the New Living. I don't want to call it a translation. It's a paraphrase, but let me read it to you. David would say there, "It is my family whom God has sovereignly chosen, and he has made an everlasting covenant with me. That covenant is eternal, it is final, it is sealed, and he will continue to look after my safety and my success." And you could add to that, in spite of all of my utter failings. Now just remember, this is the reason that David was able to ascend to the throne. David doesn't ascend to the throne because he was more brilliant than others, that he was a more skillful warrior than others. This is the reason David ascends to the throne and his kingdom becomes such a great kingdom. It is because God, the God of Israel, has made a covenant with David. We would call it a covenant of love, and David never would have inherited the throne. His line would not have continued the throne, and one day Messiah never would have come through David's line to sit on that throne apart from this covenant that God made with David. So we might say God has a relationship of a covenant of love with David. Maybe to put it into vernacular, God is committed to David through thick or through thin. His commitment to David is unconditional. It is purposeful. It is total. It is to establish David's throne now, but to keep David on the throne forever. Now, it's in this covenant that God assures David that by his grace, God would provide all of the means necessary so that God might fulfill his end of the bargain with David and fulfill his purpose in David's life. Now, here's the key. It is these mighty men then that become a gift of God's grace to David. They become the means that God uses in the life of David through God's power working in them. They would perform some incredible and sometimes miraculous deeds in order for God to fulfill his purpose in David's life. So it's through these mighty men that God manifests his covenant of love to David. Through their love for David, through their devotion to David as their king. They are God's means of grace to David. They are manifestations. God says to David, "I make a covenant of love." Well, how do I know? Look at these men. They are the visible manifestations of my love to you, David. So here we are with David. He's at the end of his life, and he begins to, in a nostalgic way, kind of rehearse his history of ascending to the throne. And what he's telling his readers here is, these are the men, these are the means which God used to fulfill his covenant in my life. And as David looks back rather fondly over the years of these men that God had so wonderfully given him to bring him to the throne, He doesn't want to kind of pass off the scene without getting these men in the official record, acknowledging who they were and acknowledging God's grace to him through these men. So he's going to do so by giving us the names of 37 of his most mighty men and reciting at least some of the exploits of some of them, which become illustrative of exploits he could have written of all of them. So we're going to see these are men of great courage. They're men of great strength. But more than that, They are men who have given themselves in loyal, loving devotion to David. So much so that every one of them is willing to lay their life on the line so that God might fulfill his purpose in the life of David. So I want to start just by reading the first couple of stories of David's mighty men. I think they're pretty much self-explanatory, but as we go through this, remember the greater point that we'll kind of wind down to at the end. If we see this much grace in the Old Covenant, then how much more grace do we experience in the New Covenant? So let's start in verse 8. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Bashabeth, the Techmanite, chief of the captains. He was called Adino the Eznite because of 800 slain by him at one time. So you could see the miraculous nature here, God using these men as means. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahoite, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there to battle and the men of Israel had withdrawn. And he arose and struck the Philistines until his hand was weary and clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to strip the slain. By the way, you see at the end of verse 9, even when all the rest of the people retreat in fear, David's mighty men stand with him. And the people only return, the end of verse 10, to gather up the spoil after the battle is over. So take note then. David attributes this incredible power of these men to God himself. Verse 10, it was the Lord who brought about a great victory through these men. They are manifestations of God's covenant love to David so that God might fulfill his purpose in David's life. Again, verse 11. Now after him was Shammah, the son of Agi, the Hararite. And the Philistines were gathered into a troop where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. Again, everybody is running in the other direction, but he, Shammah, took his stand in the midst of the plot, defended it, and struck the Philistines, and the Lord brought about a great victory. So you get the picture. Here's a group of men. They are unconditional in their love and loyalty to David, and they are committed to God, to David, that God might use them to bring about his will in David's life. And God works through these mighty men as a means of grace to David to accomplish his purpose in David's life. Now, I want to take you to the next story, but I want to kind of do it in a little more detail. It is a fascinating story. They make movies out of stories like this. Now, we're not sure. Scholars aren't of the specific context. Let me give you the two best choices. Number one is 1 Samuel chapter 22. At that point, David is not yet the king. Saul is the king, and Saul knows David's been anointed to be the next king, so he's trying to eliminate David, and David is on the run for 13 years. David is on the run in the wilderness from Saul, and what Saul does is he pays off the Philistines and he enlists them to kill David so it won't look bad for him in front of the Hebrew people. So that could be the context here. I think the better choice is 2 Samuel chapter 5. In 2 Samuel 5, David actually is the king, and he spent a couple years uniting what was a previous civil war and uniting the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel into one solid, unified kingdom again. But in doing that, he and his army they have exercised such energy and there's been such a wear and tear that the Philistines, as they are watching this from afar, they see it as an opportunity that they might be able to come and conquer Israel, who is just about exhausted in fighting each other. Now, whatever the context is, the story is going to play out the same. So as we come to our story, David is holed up in a cave, and victory seems to be out of his reach. So let's jump into the story. It's fascinating. Verse 13. Then three of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in the harvest time to the cave of Adullam. Let me give you a little picture here of this. Actually is a cave in Adullam, as best I understand. This is what these caves looked like. They were everywhere in this part of the world. And it was during that time when David was in this cave, when a troop of the Philistines was camping in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold where the garrison, he was in the cave where the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. Let me just give you a map here. You get a little bit of a picture. You remember David was born in Bethlehem. Adullam is about 13 miles southwest of Bethlehem. It's actually on the border of the Philistines and the Israel borderline. And Rephaim is located right in the middle. So there is a troop of Philistine soldiers who are hunting for David out in this wilderness area, and they're about 7 miles away looking for him in the various caves and mountains. Then there is a garrison of Philistine soldiers in David's hometown, right in the heart of Israel. They have actually taken part of the land of Israel. So what you have here is David is not only blocked out from his homeland, he's blocked out from his hometown. And just note the time of year here, and I will move this forward a little bit. The time of year in verse 13 is the harvest time. Now, if you know anything about Israel, that is the hottest and that is the driest time of the year in the land of Israel. And David is holed up in a cave in this area that certainly is not known for having an abundant amount of water supplies. So David's at a low point in his life. He is hunkered down in a hot and dry cave in the region of Adullam, really in the area of the Philistines. He is separated from his homeland, his hometown, and he's kind of right in the sights of the Philistine army. But thank God David's not alone. At least three of his mighty men are with him. And maybe in a moment of self-pity, maybe in a moment of nostalgic wishful longing, David begins to think out loud. He begins to crave, to long, to desire some fresh water, specifically from a well that's driven by a spring located in the little village of Bethlehem where he was raised. Verse 15, David had a craving. We don't know how many days he was in this cave. We don't know how long it's been since he's had water. David says, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Now, the Hebrew language here does not communicate this as a command from the king to his soldiers. It communicates more a wishful thinking. You try to put yourself in David's sandals here. Bethlehem was his home. It was the place that was near and dear to his heart. It was the place of so many childhood memories which maybe are flowing through his mind over these days. His family had lived there for generations. It was in Bethlehem he was anointed by Samuel to be the next king of Israel. But now his hometown's occupied by the enemies of God. And here's David. He is forced to flee his homeland. He is a refugee, not in a palace where kings would normally hold up, but in some lonely, dark, hot, dry cave. And again, water is very scarce to come by in the land of Israel. And if you would come by any water in this part of the world, it would usually be kind of an open little rock cistern of a little pool of water that had been exposed to the elements and the sun and the bugs and the animals and not very palatable for quenching one's thirst. So as David sits in this cave, his mind begins to drift back to his childhood, to this cool, refreshing spring located right at the city gate in the village of Bethlehem. How no doubt that cool, fresh spring of water, that well, had quenched his thirst so often as a child when he would come back from a day in the fields with the sheep and he was so thirsty. The inner longing of his heart becomes so strong for this water. David begins to think out loud. He begins to speak, and once again, maybe he's thinking he wants to be refreshed with the vigor of his youth, to be reminded of a time in his life that was far less complicated than it is today. And David's mighty men, they begin to hear the longing of their king. They hear his craving for this water, and they are willing to risk their lives to fight through the Philistine guard in order to bring their leader a drink from this well. Verse 16, so, based upon David's craving, the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water from the well of Bethlehem, which was by the gate, and they took it and they brought it to David. Now listen, this was no small task. Notice where this well was located, right in the city gate of Bethlehem. In other words, out in the open, the most public of places. This wasn't some secret spring that David found as a child. And if you would just go in the woods, around the rocks, behind a little hill, no one knows it's there. That's the spring. That's not the case here. This is not a stealth endeavor by David's men. Not only would they have to make their way to Bethlehem in the most open and public place in the village, but they would have to go somehow through the troops in Rephaim, get through or around them, make their way through the garrison in the city, and then go 12 miles back. Now, all of this danger is not lost on David. He understood the depth of loyalty and devotion of these men. The end of verse 16, nevertheless, when they brought the water back, he would not drink it. But he poured it out unto the Lord. David had a keen understanding that these men were special gifts of God's grace to him. So he offers the Lord his worship in thanksgiving of these men. I mean, to David, this water represented the blood of these precious men. It was a symbol of their unconditional commitment and devotion to him. The fact that they would literally put their lives on the line for him, it humbles David. So he says in verse 17, and he said, be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Shall I drink of the blood of these men who went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things the three mighty men did. So these three men had spontaneously responded to the wish of their leader. As Paul said in Acts chapter 20 and verse 24, they did not count their lives dear unto themselves. And David acknowledges this humble, loyal devotion by demonstrating his own gratitude to them and God by refusing to drink the water that he so had longed for. Now, I imagine we could stop the story here and have enough to talk about. We certainly can talk about how the devotion of these men to their king is an example. It's an example of all followers of Christ and the devotion we should have to our king. And that would be a great message. Or we could also talk about the sacrifice of these men and how their sacrifice, maybe we would say, parallels the sacrifice of Mary, the mother, the sister of Martha, the sister of Lazarus. When she took her life savings, a bottle of nard, she shattered that marble glass and poured out her entire life savings upon Christ, anointing him for his death and burial. And how that instructs us that all of us, like Mary, like these men, ought to be willing to do all that we can to show the same devotion they did to our king. So we could talk about all of that. But let me get to the heart of this story, because it's very subtle. It's very subtle unless you're of a Hebrew mind and you're reading this in the first century or the way back David's time in the Hebrew culture. Because there's much more grace than all of that to be seen in this passage. The grace of God is not just seen in this passage through the loving devotion of David's mighty men and all that they're willing to risk for him. But there is another incredible way that God's grace is manifest in this passage. You see, not only were these men manifestations of covenantal love to David, but they were manifestations of God's covenantal love to David. In other words, these just weren't loyal men. They were loyal men whom God had handpicked to place in the life of David so that David would see God's love and devotion to him through these men. To state it clearly, these were wonderful gifts of God's grace to David. And as we saw in some of the earlier stories, they manifest that love in incredible, courageous ways of devotion, and all of them, it could be written about the same. Their love to David was deep, it was loyal, it was selfless. And as we see in each of these stories, they were each willing to lay down their lives for David. And all of it is simply a greater manifestation of God's love towards David, who one day would lay down his life for David at the cross of Calvary. So, I want you to understand what David writes next. He's going to save some ink. He's going to save a little bit of scroll. And instead of writing down story after story after story of the incredible deeds of these mighty men and what they did for David, David's going to give us a few more illustrations, but he wants to get every one of these gifts of grace on the official record. So what he does next is simply name the names of the rest of the men. Now the implication is each one was a gift of God's grace. Each one of them was utterly loyal and devoted to David, and each one of them at different times laid their lives on the line in incredible, if not miraculous, ways so that God might accomplish his work in the life of David. So you got to stick with me now. I'm going to read this list. It's going to be a challenge for me and a challenge for you, but you've got to stick with me. You've got to get the names. Starting in verse 18, Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zariah. He was chief of the 30, and he swung his spear against 300 and killed them, and the name as well as the three, and had a name as well as the three. He was most honored of the 30, therefore he became their commander. However, he did not attain to the three. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds, killed the two sons of Ariel of Moab. He also went down and killed a lion in the middle of the pit on a snowy day. He killed an Egyptian, an impressive man, think Goliath. Now the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but when he went down to him with a club, he snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. These things Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, did and had a name as well as the three mighty men. He was honored among the 30, but he did not attain to the three, and David appointed him over his guard. Asahel, the brother of Joab, was among the 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem. Shammah the Herodite. Elikah the Herodite. Helez the Paltite. Ira, the son of Ikish, the Tekoite, Abizar the Anathothite, Mebunai the Hushathite, Zalman the Hoathite, Ahirai the Netophathite, Helib the son of Baan the Netophathite, Itai, thank God for that one, right? Itai the son of Ribai of Gibeah, of the sons of Benjamin, Benaiah the Pirathonite, Hiddai of the books of Gaash, Abiaoban the Arbathite, Asmaveth the Barhumite, Eliabah the Shalbanite, the sons of Jashin and Jonathan, Shammah the Herite, Ahiam the son of Sharar the Erite, Eliphelet the son of Ashabai, the son of Machathite, Elam, the son of Ahithophel, and the Gilonite, Hezro, the Carmelite, Peri, the Arbite, Egel, the son of Nathan, Zoba, Bani, the Gadite, Zelek, the Ammonite, Nahari, the Berethite, armor bearers of Joab, sons of Zurai, Ira, the Ithrite, Gareb, the Ithrite. Finally, last but not least, Uriah the Hittite. Uriah the Hittite. 37 in all. Now, first of all, I want you to know that David doesn't place Uriah last here because he's concerned about going in alphabetical order. That's not his issue. The entire passage is given to emphasize the grace of God in David's life through these most loyal and loving, devoted, mighty men. So here are 37 separate individual gifts of God's grace to David. They are manifestations of God's gracious covenantal love. They are the most loyal and devoted men that ever walked the planet. Each of these manifestations of God's special love to David, each of them in different ways at different times, risking their lives for David. And David places the name Uriah last. For in the Hebrew, it's last for emphasis. If all of these 36 weren't enough examples of God's grace in my life, let me give you the mountaintop. And that is Uriah. And that emphasizes the infinite grace in David's life. In other words, if you thought that these 36 were great measures of God's grace in my life, wait till I give you number 37. Now, for those of you who are sitting or listening, and you're not exactly sure who Uriah is, let me give you a brief review, all right? Because he's mentioned among David's 37 mighty men, that means that he was a loyal and devoted follower of David, and that there were certain times in the past where he risked his life for David. I'm going to state it clearly, Uriah was a token of God's covenantal love towards David. No doubt he had demonstrated that love for David's behalf at numerous times, risking his life, doing many mighty, if not miraculous, deeds so that God could fulfill his purpose in David's life. Uriah now also, beyond all of that, was a man who had a lovely wife. And one day, when Uriah was out for battle, now David should have been out for battle with his men, with Uriah, but he did not. You remember the verse there, 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 1. Then it happened. When the Bible says then it happened, it means something is about to happen. Then it happened in the spring at the times when the kings would go out to battle that David stayed in Jerusalem. And when evening came, he was walking on the roof of the palace, and he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. You may remember the story. When David should have been out with his men, he decided to stay in the luxury and comfort in the palace, enjoy all the pleasures of palace life. And he saw a woman bathing, and she was beautiful to look at, and he sent his men, and they took her. And he seduced her, and he impregnated her. And when he knew she was impregnated, he had to figure out how to cover his deed. So he sent word to bring Uriah back from battle. And he was going to give Uriah a night of reward with his wife for all of the good he had done for him. But Uriah was far too devoted to David and the men that he's fought by. And he spent the night outside on his porch of his house. And he never had relations with his wife. So David had to find a way around this. And he so trusted Uriah because he had proven to be so loyal and so devoted in the past that he gave him a letter with the words of his own murder to give to Joab, who would send Uriah to the front of the battle and call him not back until he died. Unbelievable. In other words, the same love and loyal devotion that Uriah had shown to David on numerous times was not extended by David to Uriah. That covenantal love that God had manifest to David through this one special gift of grace, a man named Uriah, was completely turned away by David's betrayal and murder of one of his mighty men. I mean, listen. The truth of the matter is, when you understand the story in this light, it's hard to imagine anyone ever falling further than David, showing so little gratitude to either men or God. His lust is inexcusable. His betrayal is unimaginable. And his murderous act towards Uriah is only exceeded by the murderous act of the Jewish religious leaders towards the Son of God himself. That's how bad it was for David. Now here's the point. By placing Uriah's name right here at the end of the list, David is saying that God was so gracious to me that in spite of this inconceivable gratitude towards him, that I took this real living manifestation of God's covenant of love to me and I utterly despised it through betrayal and adultery and even murder. David's saying God's grace wasn't exhausted in my life even when I went to that length to sin. That he in eternity past had made an eternal covenant of love with me, and he was going to fulfill his end of the bargain no matter how we utterly fail him in the process. He never even removed David from the line of Messiah. He never disregarded his plan for David's life. He never canceled out even 1 ounce of his grace for David. In fact, I love this. Listen to what David says later, Psalm chapter 16 and verse 10. God would not leave my soul in hell, nor would he let me, his holy child, rot in the abyss of the dead forever. But instead, because of grace, but instead, he will continue to reveal to me the path of life, and one day I shall enter in to the fullness of joy in his presence, and I will experience at his right hand pleasures forevermore. Beloved, that's grace. That is grace. It's grace to an ingrate like David. It's grace to a traitor like David. It's grace to an utterly selfish believer like David. It is God extending his love and his mercy to David that David did not earn, that David could never keep, that David never even deserved. And listen, if you think that grace was available to David in the old covenant, this is the whole point. Even more grace is available to us in the new covenant. And I want to show you this. I'm going to give you two examples and we'll just be done in a minute. But turn to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 7. I'm going to take you to two passages in Acts. Now Acts chapter 7 is Stephen. Stephen the deacon. Let me clarify. Stephen the deacon from the first century church in Jerusalem. And he is preaching a sermon on the history of Israel. And he gets to David, of course, David's in the story. And he says this in verse 46. David, you see it's in italics, he borrows it from the previous verse. David found favor. The word is charis, charon, charis, grace. David found favor in God's sight. We read that David found grace in God's sight. You see, the only difference between David and any other sinner is the grace of God. The only difference between you and David is the grace of God. The only difference between me and David is the grace of God. And the only time David sinned was not with Bathsheba and all the events surrounding that, because in this story, David sins again, saying that he's going to build a temple for God when his hands are bloody, which disqualified him. So what Stephen is saying here is even when David sinned, he found grace in God's sight. But that's not the height of God's grace to David. I want you to turn to Acts chapter 13. This is the Apostle Paul. And he also is reciting a bit of Israel's history. And he's going to go through the story just like Stephen. He's going to point out different things, some of the lies pretty much of the same people. And when he gets to David in verse 22, look at what he says. After God had removed King Saul, he raised up David to be their king. Now concerning whom? Concerning David. He also testified. This is God, and here's what he testified concerning David. I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. Really? After what we just saw? But he goes further. And he said this, who, speaking of David, will do all my will. Are you kidding me? Did we read that right? David is a man after my own heart, and he is one who will do all of my will. That's God's testimony for David. He's a man after my own heart, and in my eyes, he did everything I wanted him to do. That's the official record. That's grace. That's grace. What is grace? It is God taking my sin and placing it on Christ on the cross and crushing Jesus, treating him like he lived my life. And it is God taking Jesus' righteousness and placing it on me now and treating me like I lived Jesus' life. And beloved, that is the grace of God to all of those of us who are in Christ. Let's bow. Men, you could come forward.